Let the record show that the House Transportation meeting started at 7 minutes after 1, and that the following members are present: Representative Feige, Representative Munoz, Representative Peterson, and myself, Wilson. And I just want to remind everyone to please shut off your cell phones, because even when they're on vibrate, they interfere with our microphones. So before we start, well, I do want to introduce my staff. I'd like to recognize Nancy, who is our House Recording Secretary over there against the wall, and Lori is our LIO monitor, and Becky Rooney is my Committee 8. So today we have a very aggressive schedule with 3 bills on the calendar. First, we'll hear House Bill 271, Commercial Motor Vehicle Requirements, then House Bill 258, Naturally Occurring Asbestos, and then on to 270, Warning of Airport Pat-Downs. So Representative Keller, would you please come forward and introduce yourself and your staff and your bill? You have other requirements, and so you're going to leave us shortly?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and thank you, committee, for hearing the bill. I'm Representative Wes Keller. I represent Wasilla, and HB 271 is the bill that I'm bringing before you. Yes, I'm going to leave shortly and leave my capable staff, Jim Pound, to answer questions, but I wanted to say that I think that you'll find this a positive and kind of a fun bill. It's all it does is expands the, it raises the GVWR, the gross vehicle weight rating, from 10,000 to 14,000, and that will allow our better pickups that are out there now to operate and not be in the commercial category. That's the bottom line. The interest, if you like to, I have a commercial driver's license, driven for years, like to drive, like trucks, you know. And trucks have changed a lot over the years. And now you buy a good three-quarter ton truck, and the GVWR is over the 10,000 limit for non-commercial vehicles. So with that, I want to tell you, too, that it's been well supported and even suggested by Alaska Trucking Association, and FIB is on board. We've been working closely with the Department of Transportation. They're all represented here. So in jest, if you mess this one up, I'll never get one through. Everybody's here. I think everybody's. I'm just saying that in a lighthearted way. But if I could, then I'd just turn over to Jim.
Thank you. And would you mind, we need to have the committee substitute version I before us.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move CS for House Bill 271 version I for discussion.
Okay. Hearing no objection, we have version I before us. And Jim, if you want to go ahead and explain the bill a little bit further.
All right. For the record, I'm Jim Pound, staff representative Keller. Madam Chair, I think Representative Keller pretty much laid it up. What we're essentially dealing with are pickup trucks for the most part. The current statute was written around 1999. Pickup trucks were a lot smaller then than they are now. A lot of these vehicles that we're talking about are, for example, pilot trucks. And by giving this additional up to 14,000 pounds, currently most pilot trucks have to be three-quarter tons. This will allow them to go to the one-ton duallys. The duallys, for example, because it puts more tire on the road is in less pounds per square inch, actually help the roads a little bit as well, which I was advised of that from NORCOM. I am not an expert when it comes to trucking. I'll admit that. Fortunately, I have experts here. And I believe Mr. Thompson is online. Mr. Brendan from DOT is on, is here in the room. And in all honesty, as far as answering a lot of the specific questions, I think they can probably answer them better than I can.
Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
I have a question. In terms of the savings and cost and time and perhaps there's an inspection fee, I'm not sure. Could you address what the actual savings would be if this were implemented for the small business owners?
Through the chair, that again, I think I'd have to yield to DOT to tell you specifics on how much money is involved in the actual fees and licensing and inspection process and other restrictions that may apply to a difference between 10 and 14,000. I think one of the biggest ones we talked about is a lot of the individuals driving pilot vehicles are under 18. They're not eligible for CDL. This would allow them to drive and continue operating a one-ton vehicle and still be able to work towards getting their CDL that way. The one other one you always see all the time, or where it sits right now, if there's a construction job going on, kids working on the construction job, the driver, the boss says, I need to run down to the lumber yard and pick up a load of lumber, use your truck, and he's using his personal vehicle. That would be a question of whether that suddenly became a commercial vehicle, just because he was making that run.
Representative Feigin.
What's the difference between the first version and the I version?
Primary change between the first version and the I version had to do with hazmat language, which does not apply to the state. Hazmat is a federal issue. Hazmat is the one that regulates. They regulate hazmat, and the state has to yield to that under a supremacy clause. And so we took that language out.
Okay. But the purpose of having those hazmat placards on the vehicle is also that vehicles involved in a wreck of some kind to notify the first responders that show up on scene that there is, in fact, some kind of hazardous material there. So what's the compelling reason for removing that?
My understanding, again, I'm going to have to yield to Mr. Breeden on that one. My understanding is that those placards are primarily federally managed.
Okay.
Can be state inspected, but they are federally managed.
Right, there's two changes here. One is on, looking on page 2, it says for intrastate commercial purposes.
Correct.
Or A, and this is all relates back to the definition of what a commercial motor vehicle is. What if a vehicle is engaged in interstate commercial purposes? Is it not considered a commercial vehicle?
If it's under 14,000 pounds, I would say it is not.
If it's under 14,000 pounds, I would say it is not.
I would say the same rules would apply for any vehicle under 14,000 GVW.
Then why put that phrase in there? Because in the other part of the rule, or in other part of the bill, top page 3, you're changing the weight.
Okay.
This is where you're changing the weight.
Okay. Let me identify through the chair. I apologize. I'm chair. And being from DOT, I think can give you a little better description of what's going on here.
You can state your name and your...
My name is Dan Breeden. I'm the Director of Measurement Standards and Commercial Vehicle Enforcement for DOT.
Okay. And can you answer Representative Feige's question?
Chair, Representative Feige. What we're talking about here is the difference between intra...
Can you speak into the microphone?
What we're talking about here is the difference between intra and interstate commerce. And what we're trying to do is deregulate those operations in intrastate commerce that would happen under those specific rules. If they're in interstate commerce, all the rules would apply as normal. And that's the difference between intra and interstate commerce.
I get the definition there, I suppose. Can't you accomplish, I guess I don't understand if basically what you're trying to do is allow things like F-350s, which people are driving as their personal vehicles for the most
right.
part. Can't you just change the weight requirement? Because now if it's below 14,000 pounds, then it's considered a private vehicle and a non-commercial vehicle simply by the weight. Correct?
Through the chair, what we've done is just that. We've raised the weight from 10 to 14,000 pounds in intrastate commerce to accommodate just what you've said. We're not regulating those vehicles. What we've done in the past is treat commercial vehicles, intra and interstate, the exact same to create a level playing field. What would be required here if we were to regulate those vehicles under 14,000 pounds currently, drivers under 18 would not be able to drive those vehicles. and all the rules associated with the hours of service and whatever else we would impose upon them would apply, and it's pretty much unacceptable from what we've all discussed to regulate that way in interstate commerce just because of what the federal requirements are. They're overreaching.
So if I can paraphrase from what I understand you're saying is that when it's in-state, we'd like to control it ourselves when it's in-state because we've got a lot of drivers and younger drivers that maybe are driving vehicles for their own personal use that weigh more than that, and we don't want to have them have to have the commercial rules and regulations when it's their personal vehicle. And so if they're driving in-state, they can go by the state rules unless they're interstate, and then if it's interstate, then they have to go by what the federal laws say.
Madam Chair, that's pretty, yeah, that's accurate.
Okay, so if I may, Madam Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
So if it's a commercial vehicle, it's involved in intrastate, why would you, are you saying that the hazmat rules would or would not apply?
Through the Chair, that the hazmat rules would absolutely apply to any hazmat operation regardless of the size of the vehicle. If you carry a placardable quantity of hazardous material, interstate rules apply because that's a federal program through and through. It actually has nothing to do with us. We enforce it because we adopt those federal laws, but the feds and or the laws apply regardless.
And why was this
follow-up, Representative Feige?
Why was this paragraph in there in the first place?
The paragraph?
Line 9, page 2. And also on the next page, line 4.
Oh, those are redundant statements that the rule applies without those statements, so we figured those statements were redundant and should be removed just for clarity.
Okay, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You, Jim, had said something that kind of struck me as odd, that there were people driving pilot cars that were under the age of 18. I hired numerous, more drivers than I could count in my business career, and the number one requirement was that they had to be over 18. Otherwise, I couldn't get insurance for them if they were under 18. So I'm wondering how someone who's driving a pilot vehicle, presumably the reason there's a pilot vehicle is because there's a person following behind him that has an extremely large load, bigger than is normally allowed. And so they're going to have a special permit just to travel down the roadway. I don't see how you could get someone qualified or be allowed to drive that pilot car that's under the age of 18.
To the Chair, that I know of some people who drive pilot vehicles who are under 18. For one, and for two, at the same time, necessarily how many of those people had CDLs, and how many of people who had a CDL were interested in driving a pilot vehicle. I mean, the CDL requirement kicks in here at 10,000 pounds. This would take that up to 14,000 for those people who don't. There may be people out there who just want to drive pilot vehicles and not ever want to drive a truck and never want to have a CDL for whatever reason.
Well,
follow up, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you also had mentioned when you were giving your opening statement about that you thought that there'd be less road wear with a vehicle weighed 14,000 versus 10,000. I wasn't exactly sure what exactly the context was that said there.
Through the Chair, Representative, that refers to dualies, the dual-wheel trucks. It reduces our road wear.
Okay.
All right. And I wouldn't say that a one-ton single would do that.
All right. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Any other questions? Representative Feige.
In Section 3, that particular section, does that apply to other Does that definition then apply to others? I have a note here that says if we change that, that it would remove the authority for the state to inspect vehicles under this section involved in interstate commerce.
Through the chair, Representative, this basically means nothing. It allows us to not regulate intrastate operations. Our interstate regulations are adopted in 17AC Chapter 25, and we adopt those federal regulations by reference. So all those rules would apply, and this would just eliminate, again, the intrastate operations in vehicles less than 14,000 pounds.
Okay, so this particular...
Follow-up, Representative
Eigen. Yes, Madam Chair. This section only applies to, in Title 19, not 17?
Clarify, through the chair, please clarify the...
Okay, in section 3 of the bill, bottom of page 2, line 23. Does the state have an authority to inspect interstate commerce somewhere else besides in Title 19?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Leahy. Yes, in Alaska Administrative Code 17, we adopt those almost in their entirety in the 49 CFR 300 to 399.
Thank you, Manager.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have from... Aves Thompson, who is online with the Alaska Truckers Association. Aves, are you there?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Okay, go ahead and state your name and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Aves Thompson, the Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association. The Alaska Trucking Association is a statewide organization representing the interests of our nearly 200 member companies from Barrow to Ketchikan. Freight movement represents a large chunk of our economy and impacts all of us each and every day. The simple truth is that if you got it, the truck brought it. As vehicles have gotten larger and heavier, many vehicles now fall into the current definition of an intrastate commercial motor vehicle that have historically not been considered commercial vehicles, such as pickup trucks, small step vans, small trailers, etc. One of the Alaska Trucking Association's legislative priorities is to change the definition of an intrastate commercial vehicle to reduce the regulatory burden on small business. For purposes of commercial vehicle regulation and inspection, the CS for House Bill 271 raises the weight threshold on intrastate commercial vehicles from 10,000 pounds gross vehicle weight rating to 14,000 pounds, again for inspection and safety regulation purposes. This is aimed at small contractors, for example, lawn care folks, carpenters, plumbing and heating, small delivery vehicles, and pilot cars. Pickup trucks and small step vans are getting larger and heavier and are bumping over the current 10,000 pounds GVWR, becoming, by definition, a commercial vehicle for those inspection and safety inspection purposes. Pilot cars are those vehicles that accompany oversized loads to serve as an extension of the warning system for the oversized load, and their work is almost always intrastate and would fall under this legislation. This bump over the 10,000 mark, the current 10,000 mark, causes the driver to obtain medical certification, complete daily vehicle inspection reports, perform or have performed annual inspections, and the vehicle must submit several other items to the state DOT to be in compliance. When over the 10,000 pound threshold, these vehicles are subject to federal regulations that have been adopted into the Alaska Administrative Code. When passed, this bill will exclude these commercial vehicles that are no more than 14,000 pounds gross vehicle weight rating from the unnecessary regulation. This change does not change the commercial status of these intrastate vehicles for purposes of registration with the Division of Motor Vehicles, and therefore there is no fiscal impact on the state. These vehicles do not need that level of scrutiny, as typically they are operating in a limited geographical area and are not subject to the wear and tear that other larger commercial vehicles experience. On behalf of the Alaska Trucking Association, I urge you to act favorably on this bill, and I'll try to answer any questions. Thank you for your attention.
Aves, I know it sounds like there's a lot of bookwork that could be involved, but what about the cost to do those extra steps? Or what do you know what the cost difference is?
Madam Chair, there's costs associated with acquiring the forms. I don't believe there's any cost in registering, or registering might not be the right word, registering with the United States Department of Transportation to get a DOT number. I think those are free. But along with that comes some other regulations in terms of annual reporting on the number of vehicles, number of drivers, insurance updates, and things like that. The inspections themselves are time-consuming. Takes anywhere from 5 to 10, 15 minutes at the end of each day because you need to check the vehicle, walk around it, and then prepare a report form that needs to go into the dispatcher or the management of your company. And those then must be held and will be subject to audit later. Medical certifications, you go to the doctor, you know what that costs, Madam Chair. You have to do that every 2 years. We feel it's some unnecessary regulation, and that this bill will lighten the burden on those small business folks and quite frankly, some of our members who operate pilot cars. So we feel it will be of benefit to a whole lot of people.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Peterson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was wondering at what weight or when is a commercial vehicle required to weigh at one of the scales that are situated along the sides of several highways around the state?
Through the Chair, Representative Peterson, at the current time it's 10,000 pounds.
Madam Chair, so
presumes that the vehicle is commercial. Okay. So in this case, a 14,000 pound non-commercial vehicle is not required to stop at the weigh station.
Okay.
Under this bill.
Okay.
Thank you. That was the point I was trying to make.
Any other questions? Representative, I'm sorry, Representative Pruitt has joined us quite some time ago. Representative Pruitt.
Madam Chair, one of the things that I would note being in the industry, that it's having the lower limit, you see there's a lot of people you wouldn't think of that have to deal with this, and it's time consuming. It can be a cost to them. Let's just say an independent contractor for a package delivery, driving out to Wasilla to do their delivery, they'll have to take if they're backed up, could be anywhere from 5 to 45 minutes to stop at a weigh station. There's the issue with the cost of getting the physical, and sometimes when you're dealing with some of these smaller companies, the individual's there probably not for multiple years on end. They're going to be there for probably 6 months, and when you have that rolling stock at $150 or more, it can cost a lot to those companies. So I think by doing this, we're really helping some of those small business owners and some of those independent contractors out there that have to deal with this stuff and really shouldn't have to with the better technology in the vehicles that we have and what they can withstand. So I just put that out there since that's what I work in and I get to see some of this stuff. So.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grunberg?
No, I just wanted the record to reflect I'm here.
Oh, Representative Grunberg. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had a question, and I'm sorry. I forgot that you weren't here to begin with.
And that's all right. I'm customarily silent at these meetings.
is here also.
I just wanted to say that this was a good bill, and I checked it out, and I'm glad to be allowed to co-sponsor it.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
What is the Department of Transportation's feeling about this legislation? Have they weighed in on it, or?
I see heads bobbing back. Yeah, go ahead. Come on up, and put, so we can have it on the record.
Good question.
For the record, I'm Dan Breeden again with the Measurement Standards and Commissioner of Enforcement. And we are, Madam Chair, we're very much in favor of this passing as written.
Representative Broomberg.
I think I'm going to ask Mr. Pound this. I'm sorry. I'd like to look at the title. Right. It relates to the state highway system. Yeah, commercial vehicle requirements, that's fine. But the state highway system, unless you folks want the proverbial barn door, I would suggest we narrow it a bit.
Through the chair, would you recommend eliminating the word state or going the other way?
Wait, that wouldn't do it.
All right. I'm sorry.
I'll offer at the appropriate time a conceptual amendment that the title be narrowed as tightly as we can, and I'm just going to make it a general thing, conceptually.
Well, do we have anyone else in the room that wants to testify?
Madam Chair.
Just a minute.
I'm sorry.
Do we have anyone else in the room that wants to testify? Is there anyone online that wants to testify? All right. Then we're ready for an
amendment. I have a question. I'm sorry.
Okay.
If I were to offer a conceptual amendment like that, to narrow the title as much as possible, would the sponsor be agreeable?
Through the chair, it would not be a problem.
Thank you. I just wanted that on the record.
Okay. Okay. All right. Now we're ready for an amendment, then, and I will close testimony on this.
Madam Chair.
Representative Broomberg.
I would offer a conceptual amendment to narrow the title as narrowly as possible and to give the, if it's agreeable with the chair, the sponsor the opportunity to review that before the bill. Yeah, so so the sponsor sees what we're doing. If that's okay with you.
Okay. Do I hear any, is there an objection? Hearing no
objection. Add to that, I think you could make a change by adding language. The title begins, an act relating to the state highway system. Then you could add, and the weight threshold limits for commercial motor vehicles. And that, I think, would cover it. But, you know, we could...
Well, if I may dialogue, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Broomberg.
That would be fine for the second half of it. But I'm concerned about the first half. Because you could have everything from bridge namings and
that's
you
true.
Name it.
That's right.
So, I would certainly think that would do it for the second half, and I'd find that very acceptable. But I'd like, and I leave it up to the bill drafters, and you know, I think that's a good suggestion.
I'm surprised that the bill drafter left it that wide. But hearing no objection, so the amendment number one passed. Do I hear a motion from anyone? Representative Munoz.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move CS for House Bill 271, amended version I, with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Okay. Hearing no objection, so moved. All right.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now we will, we're just going to take a little brief at ease. And fill out these papers. Forrest, would someone like to move version E?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move CS for House Bill 258, version E, for discussion.
Okay.
I will object just for discussion.
All right. Representative Jewell, would you like to go ahead and
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the Transportation Committee, thank you for hearing this bill. I'm going to keep my remarks brief and leave it to my committee aide, Brody Anderson, and Emily Newman from Ledge Legal to cover the substance of the bill, since I need to be at another place. Naturally occurring asbestos occurs in several parts of the state.
This is an extra copy.
And there have been ways to mitigate that issue, whether it's been along the Dalton or here in Juneau or elsewhere. But it's been a reoccurring problem in the upper Cobuk communities of Ambler in particular, but Cobuk as well, to the point that, well, if I could, Madam Chairman, I'll just read a very, very brief statement from the FAA Airports Division, Alaska Region. Project delayed until a suitable material source can be found that does not contain asbestos. And this has to do with the Ambler Airport. We've not been able to turn a shovel on capital projects in that community for several years. And we had a bill at one point sought to rectify this. Unfortunately, things did not work out. We felt necessary to come back with the bill, move this forward. We've been working with the parties from the administration, with Ledge Legal. We've talked to the Department of Transportation, and Madam Chairman, there are some land ownership issues that make this problem unique, but the issue is, in its naturally occurring state, we have asbestos, and it kicks up fugitive dust any time that an airplane lands or takes off. It's kicking up dust. We cannot turn a shovel to fix water and sewer systems. We cannot turn a shovel to do new housing projects. We have a bridge that's close to collapse. We have an airport that is in need of repair. We have the school playground issues. And you know, some of those things is we're painfully aware, actually gleefully aware. When we get capital projects for our community, that means communities can go to work. People can go to work, and they can provide for their families. And unfortunately, this has not been the case in Ambler, and it's also hampered a school construction project in Cobuk. So Brody and Emily will go through the nuances of the bill. I appreciate the fact that you're hearing it at this point, and I understand, Madam Chairman, that you wish to hold this bill, and we'll hear it again at some point in the near future, and that's great, as I would like to see this bill move along. But I appreciate the time, and as you'll see, and probably through public testimony and others, that we've really tried to work this bill with the third floor, with the departments, to get it as far as we can in this process and try and come to a place where people can be supportive and so we can move this. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Okay. And I just have a question. Just to give me an idea of naturally occurring asbestos. I mean, is it causing health problems for people in the community, or is this just something that is occurring and it's not that big of a deal?
In its natural state, I do not believe at this point that there are any known health related impacts that have occurred. I believe a few years ago, some people were surveyed, and that survey came away fairly clean, except for people who had other issues going on, whether they were using tobacco or other things. So, and that's been a few years, but to my knowledge, Madam Chair, it's where it becomes problematic is how it's regulated by our state.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bloomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jewell, this bill does not go to judiciary and has some extensive tort immunity sections in it. And we have several members of Judiciary Committee on our committee here. My concern, and I'm glad we're not going to move this right this minute, because I want to take a look at whether the immunity grant may be broader than necessary. Let me give you an example. There was a case called Reader versus Gem Company involving somebody up in Nome who was unloading a dump truck, basically, and lost his thumb. And the question is not irrelevant, but it arose. And the way this thing is written now, it looks to me like the immunity section, which is section 2 of the bill, says...
Could you tell us what page and what line?
Sure. It basically is on page 3, lines 15 through page 4, line 11, generally. And specifically it says, and I'm looking at lines 27 and following on page 3, for an act or omission occurring in the course of extracting, supplying, transporting, or using gravel, blah, 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 as long as the requirements of these permitting sections are met. You could have somebody who works for a trucking company, we'll say, who gets behind the wheel and they're drunk and they hit somebody. I think that might be immunized under this, and I'm not sure that we want to go that far. So I want to have somebody be able to look at this and talk with me here on this.
Through the chair, Madam Chair, and Representative Gruenberg, I think you'll get a chance to hear some of the work that's got into it specifically. And that's been the section that has, as you can well imagine, Representative Gruenberg, has taken the time to work through, and we've had many minds focusing on this issue, and would be glad for your input.
Thank you.
And what my intentions are is to go ahead and hear the testimony, and then I want, if there's any concerns, we need to kind of talk about them and hash them out so that we know exactly where to mark the bill and if it's needed. Now, if we don't think it's needed, I don't have a problem with moving the bill today. But I just want to make sure that we are covering these the areas that need to be taken care of.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bloomberg.
I think I objected for the purpose of discussion to the adoption of the CS. And it's less important for me to go over the differences between the two versions since we're dealing with the CS, so I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With that, I'll leave it.
Okay.
And Brody and Emily Sands, thank you very much. Members of the committee, appreciate you hearing the bill.
Now, Brody, do you have anything else to add as before we go on?
Madam Chair, I could definitely explain the process in which we've gotten to version E from where we started with version B if the committee would prefer to hear how the steps taken. If not, also we do have Emily Newman from Ledge Legal who can walk through the sectional, and that might bring out more discussion. So I'm at the...
Let's go ahead and go through the sectional first then, and then if we have any questions, then we can ask as we go along. So, Emily, thank you for coming forward.
Good afternoon. My name is Emily Nauman. I'm here from Legal Services to go over sectional. And if you'd like to interrupt me or after I'm done, I'd be happy to answer any questions as best as I can.
Let's do it as we go along so that we can... look at it that way per section. Representative Groomer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Nauman, and everybody else who's going to testify, I hope that you will take a little detail on the immunity sections and the questions that I've raised anyway, because I haven't studied the rest of this, but I can see where this is going, and I'm just concerned about the possible overbreadth in the immunity.
Brody.
Madam Chair, also, just to be clear, Emily will be referencing the legal sectional that she should have. Oh. Then I provided a more detailed sectional of actually what the bill does. So Emily will be referencing the legal sectional, and then we can refer back to my sectional if necessary.
Is this yours?
Through the Chair, Representative Gunberg, yes it is.
I don't know if I have the ledge legal. I don't seem to have one that
I don't have any. Okay, we'll see if we can.
Is that an extra one? Is that yours?
No, you can have that one. I need the copy, though.
Thank you.
I need the copy.
You have one?
To begin, Section 1 of the bill contains legislative findings and purpose statements to explain and support the measure. Section 2 creates the immunity sections that Representative Gruenberg was referring to before.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. I'd like you, please, to go over in a little detail the immunity section.
You already said that.
But I thought she was going on to the next one now. Oh, she's not. Oh, okay.
The immunity section provides, basically forecloses a suit against the defendant on the basis of ownership of land or in the course of extracting, supplying, transporting, or using gravel or other aggregate material containing naturally occurring asbestos less than 0.025%. as long as those actions or omissions are within the requirements of, and here we're referring to on line 30, AS 1831-250, the sections for private contractors, and AS 4442-410B is the requirements for public construction.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'm going to reserve my, I think, questions here, because I want to wait until you've described what those other reference sections are, so we can put the whole thing together.
Okay, great. Also, Section C, subsection C, forecloses a suit against the state in the course of approving or creating the monitoring and mitigation plan that would be developed under this.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'd like to go over for a minute subsection B. And this is something that the key word is on line 4, page 4, direct controller responsibility. This would seem to limit the possible defendants, and I'd like you to discuss, for the edification of the members of the committee, the difference who would be a defendant potentially who has direct control and who would be those people who do not have direct control but are potential defendants. Who are we eliminating by the use of the term direct control? What class of people?
Just give me one second here.
The reason I'm saying this, Madam Chair, is because as I don't know if there's anybody on the Labor and Commerce. Are you in Labor and Commerce? No. Okay. I have a bill that deals with antitrust, and it's called people who are directly damaged as a people who are indirectly damaged. And it's a very big, it can be a very big issue. That happens to deal with classes of plaintiffs. This clause deals with classes of defendants. And so, please.
Subsection B is a section that describes who can be sued in the event that there's noncompliance with the plan created under this bill, both the site use plan and the monitoring and mitigation plans. And it states that a suit can only be brought for noncompliance against essentially the person that has primary control over that plan, is responsible for submitting it, and has some control over the construction site.
Madam Chair, may I?
Representative Gruenberg. And then Brody, can you answer that first?
Yeah. Through the Chair, Representative Gruenberg, we discussed this portion of the immunity through the fact of if you have, through the chain of the construction project, you have extractors that are going to pull it, then you have the transporters that are going to drive it, then you have the actual construction project being built. And in order to preserve immunity for those extractors and the transporters, when you have someone who just doesn't follow the rules in the construction, those defendants that could possibly be named, they did it right. The site-specific plan identifies from the extraction all the way through the construction plan. The first two entities do it correctly. They follow the rules. The contractor that actually is in charge of the project doesn't follow the rules. This section was developed in hopes to be able to excuse those two. First, they did follow the rules, and the noncompliance was at the point of the contractor. And so from that point on, would be where the immunity was removed, if I'm correct.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'm just going to give you a hypothetical here. Suppose you have somebody who knowingly and recklessly knows that the rules are not being followed and creating a hazardous condition, and as a direct and proximate cause of that, an injury or property damage results. So the person, I'm in my hypothetical, I'm using a specific hypothetical to show somebody who would normally be quite culpable. You're immunizing that person as well as the easy example you gave. And I'm just getting people to think about this stuff now because these are things that, you know, warrant a little bit of thought.
Through the Chair, that is my understanding of how this functions, the person that would be responsible in the event of that kind of tortious action would be the person who has responsibility over the compliance requirements set out in the permitting sections of this bill.
Maybe I could have a little leeway here.
Go ahead.
I said I wasn't going to go back. The 250 and the other statutes mentioned, they're basically permitting statutes, right? And they're in the bill here, right? Yeah, they're nodding. Okay. How about, and I'm going back a little bit to the language, page 3, lines 27 through 29, 27 and 28, occurring in the course of extracting, supplying, transporting, or using gravel. And here, we could, let us say, I negligently or strict liability manufacture a piece of earth-moving equipment, and it doesn't have a safety thing on it, and somebody gets injured like Mr. Reeder did up in Nome. This would seem even to immunize the Caterpillar company or whoever manufactured the piece of equipment, wouldn't it not?
And through the Chair, I interpret this section a little bit differently in that the act or omission has to be in compliance with the permitting requirements.
Through the Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'm assuming that all the people involved in the permitting, everything was done properly. But unbeknownst to anybody, the piece of equipment, the particular earth-moving equipment in my example, had a bolt loose and it fell off and somebody lost their hand. That would seem, even by its terms, to be immunized, even though everybody in Alaska had operated in good faith. In that case, number one, would the language here not immunize the manufacturer? And number two, why should it if it does?
Through the Chair, I I don't believe, based on my reading of this section, that immunity would be extended to that circumstance, because the action has to be, again, an act or omission in compliance with the requirements of the permitting sections.
Madam Chair, maybe I'll wait till we get to those sections, and you can show me in those sections where I'm wrong, and I'll just defer, if I may, to that.
Thank you. Go ahead. And I'll tell you, my plans are to go to until about 20 minutes to 3, and then we will go on to the next bill. So,
Section 3 of the bill adds the new section 1831-250 to describe how a private person may qualify for immunity through what we've been referring to as the permitting requirement. Section 4 of the bill adds many new sections to AS 44-42, which is the DOT section. How in detail would you like me to go through these sections, given that we're on a time restraint?
Just go ahead and do what you had normally planned to do.
Madam Chair, I can quickly describe some of the sections relatively briefly.
And that's Brody.
I'm Brody Anderson, for the record, Representative Jewell's legislative aide for HB 258. When we designed the bill, this is where working with the administration has actually helped, I believe, make the bill stronger in the successfulness of the program that would be established. When we first drafted the bill, it was just open-ended, and it was suggested that there was the possibility that each region of DOT would have to create its own program in order to operate it. And what this does was this first part of the bill is in the administration section would actually create one position within the office of the commissioner to set some preliminary things before we even get to the construction phase of, you know, the site-specific plan, and that would be the creation of a database known throughout the state for all the known NOAA sites that are out there currently. Also, it would create some proximity of clean gravel sites close to where there are known NOAA sites currently. It would create a list for communities that actually have NOAA occurrences currently, which could include Juneau, actually, is one of the communities, even though there's readily available clean sources of gravel also to use in construction. Juneau does have naturally occurring asbestos locally. The next part would be then he would have to transmit those to the commissioner and then publish them on the DOT's website for public access. And it also have a projected 5-year projects that we know that are in development or will be in development over the next 5 years in those regions. And then finally, they would also look at some chances of stockpiling clean gravel. If we know we're going to do a schoolyard, we know we have to order clean gravel, what's the chance of looking at the cost of getting more gravel ordered because we have a road coming up next summer? And then they would also work in conjunction of this database with the other departments mentioned to make sure that we're covering human health and those other issues. This was a suggestion from the administration, and what it does is it regionalizes our issue. Where before we were looking at 5 major regions having to all do this, now it's handled out of one office, and it becomes a regional issue if that region has, you know, site-specific issues.
Madam Chair.
Representative Groomberg.
Thank you. Having heard your explanation, I honestly don't see how it would allow a cause of action against a defective piece of equipment, nor do I see how, if a suit were brought against the entity that owned the property or was doing the extracting, how the following would be prevented. I could see some organization getting sued who was the direct person in direct compliance here. And under the immunity section, they could not go against the equipment manufacturer for indemnification or third-party liability. So not only would the plaintiff be prevented, but the defendant would be prevented from seeking reimbursement for the person who's truly at fault.
Representative Grunberg, so you're concerned about something that might happen that has nothing to do with the NOAA.
Right. I mean, and that's just one thought. I've got to be frank that I haven't studied this as much as I want to, but I could see a terrifically unfair result being compounded here.
Representative Feige and then Representative
Griffin. I believe I understand what Representative Grunberg is getting at, but on page 3, the line 18, in paragraph A there, it does basically an action claim for damages or costs alleging an asbestos-related death, injury, disability, or asbestos-related property damage. Does that not accomplish? I mean, what we're trying to do is, I believe what the intent here is to, basically, if somebody has a asbestos-related illness, injury, or whatnot, that the company engaged in the gravel work or the construction work or whatever cannot be sued due to naturally occurring asbestos. Somebody gets thumb whacked off, although it doesn't have anything to do with the asbestos. It just has everything to do with either not following a procedure or being careless or perhaps the design of the equipment, in which case suing the manufacturer would be appropriate. But it doesn't, if it's, as long as it's asbestos related, does this paragraph not address what you're talking about?
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Representative Grunberg.
You may have an excellent point, but the term asbestos-related is nowhere defined. And if you were the defense lawyer, you would try to make that as broad as possible. Maybe I got the wrong party, but if you were representing the person, it's going to spawn litigation. And I hadn't really thought of it in those terms, and maybe that's what you intended in the drafting of the bill. I don't know. But number one, we have to then come up with a definition that does the trick, and we have to look carefully at that definition to see, even if it's well-defined, and it is clearly asbestos-related, are there some kinds of things that might clearly be asbestos-related, but you wouldn't want to immunize. Let me give you an example. Let's say they have to wear a certain type of mask, and the mask is defectively manufactured, and there are holes in the mask, and the person develops mesothelioma. That would be asbestos-related, I would think, potentially, but I don't know that you want to immunize that manufacturer either. I'm just giving some simple examples that come to me on the top of my head. And this is going to take some care. And I am concerned with a short session. Are we having the tail wag the dog here? Because it seems to me you've got a good bill here, and we're going to get potentially bollocksed up in some very difficult and policy legal questions on the immunity. I'd hate to have the tail wag the dog and the dog not be able to walk down the road.
And that sounds like maybe something that you can work on to think about and
avoid a judiciary referral.
Absolutely. And Madam Chair, the other body has a companion version of this bill. And actually, that bill does have a judiciary referral as well as a transportation referral over there. Not that I want to talk about, not that I'm referring to the other body, but the immunity has been an issue from the very start, and we have tried to work through it all, and Emily has worked with both drafters of the bill, so that is a concern that we have.
I think we kind of scrutinized maybe pretty good over here, so I do want to make sure that we do look at that anyway. Representative Pruitt, did you get to say, Representative Pruitt, did you get to say?
That was kind of what I was going to get at as well, so please.
Okay, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I surely don't claim to know all that much about asbestos, but I do understand that there are essentially there are several different types of asbestos, different forms of the element asbestos. Basically, you have a long fiber and a short fiber type asbestos, and one or the other, I believe it's the short fiber, but I could be wrong, is the type that actually causes mesothelioma. Is it worth, and again, in the definition of naturally occurring asbestos, there were some references to the various different mineral types. Part of our issue here is probably the loose definition of the asbestos that is actually damaging. Is there any possibility of tightening up the definition of what is asbestos that is actually damaging or could possibly cause public health harm?
Through the chair, Representative Feige. Yes, we've actually, as of today, actually looked at. We had some discussions with DOT on our definition of asbestos, and also maybe including a second definition with the definition of naturally occurring asbestos as well. So there's definitely, I think, as the bill sponsor, there's definitely some discussion that can be had with tightening up the definitions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. I was wondering, is Alaska the only place that has naturally occurring asbestos? And if we aren't, how are other states or other localities dealing with this problem? And do we have that information?
I would imagine, for one thing, that they've got roads that wind up all around.
So they have already gone through this problem.
through the chair, Representative Peterson, actually, California and Virginia both have an active naturally occurring asbestos program in place with regulations to monitor the use of naturally occurring asbestos. So those two states actually have a viable program up and running. And I don't have the numbers directly in front of me, but I believe there are up to 12 other states that are looking at or formulating these similar type of regulations to use naturally occurring asbestos within limited confines of construction.
And a follow-up.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would it be possible to take a look at what other legislators have structured and may have limited the culpability of people who are dealing with the natural occurring asbestos? There's no use recreating the wheel if somebody else has already, done the work.
Through the chair, Representative Pease, and I can definitely look to try to get you some of that language from that we actually did use. A lot of our bill actually comes from California's regulations, directly almost mimicked it to the in certain sections. We have expanded the immunity section that is definitely a step farther than we've taken than other states had. Also, just because of the fact is, you know, we are a little bit more hindered than other states where they do have roads that can just drive it in. We have, especially in our community up in, with the Ambler, they got gravel. Can't guarantee how clean it is and where they can get it and then the cost of it. So we definitely wanted to try to encourage the use and, you know, proper use of it. So we did take ours a little bit farther than other states, but I'll get back to you with what other states have done.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
And I don't know how you want to handle this, Madam Chair. It would truncate my questions a lot if we didn't have to get into the immunity stuff in this committee and it would go to judiciary or something where we really look at this. That would certainly save at least the other members of this committee's time, because it seems to me it's a good idea what you're doing here. And the other kinds of issues are issues we really do look at in that committee, and I really want to think about it, but I don't have any problem with the basic bill.
And this is broaching areas that the Transportation Committee usually deals with transportation, and this really isn't transportation per se, but because it's talking about building a road and some of the other things that they want to build, we're involved with it. So, Representative Munoz.
I have a question. It's not so much specific to the bill, but more specific to the area that you're trying to address, the region. And you mentioned, Representative Jewell mentioned that there was a lot of dust in the community. Is there naturally occurring asbestos in the dust? And would this, I mean, the opportunity to address the paving needs and so on in that community ultimately address those current health issues in that community?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, there is naturally occurring asbestos up there, and it has been used in the past, whether it's on, if the gravel that was used for the current airport and Ambler, you know, has it, if the roads that are out there that do exist that are gravel use it, they weren't tested at that time when they were developed. It wasn't an issue. It didn't come up. Some of the things that happened up there during the infrastructure building, they didn't have regulations or the ways to really know. They just did it. And so the fact that we now can test it, and we do, if we have found it, we have to assume that some of the stuff out there probably does have it. That's why the study that Representative Jewell was referring to, you know, he referenced the study that was done by Public Health. So, I don't know if that answers your question.
Somewhat, but
follow-up, Representative.
Is the change then in being able to access these materials, is it a federal change or a state change? What has changed in law that makes these materials not accessible now?
Through the chair. That's a great question, and I don't exactly have the answer, except for the fact is that we can test for it now, and we are prohibited in certain aspects to use it.
Currently, you can use gravel containing naturally occurring asbestos, but you have essentially possibly very open liability for suits related to people getting mesothelioma. This bill would prevent that risk by foreclosing suit on the basis of that asbestos-related illness.
So I have a question. So if we pass this, if everyone in that community got mesothelioma, I can't even say it, but if that happened, no one could sue. Is that what you're saying?
If all of the actions were in compliance with the permitting requirements, I believe that's the case, yes.
A little different subject.
I think I'd like to hear from DEC and hear what they have to say about that particular thing, because we all have questions that are swimming around on this, and I know this is highly unusual for us to stop a sectional and go to that, but because everyone has questions about it, is Alice Edwards online, or is she here?
Madam
Alice.
Chair?
Representative Bloomberg?
Just one thing on a slightly different thing, but it's a legal question.
Not right now.
Oh, okay.
Okay, Alice, if you could come forward and just answer. You've heard all the questions swirling around in our heads here. you know what we're thinking, and so kind of give us some information so that we're a little bit smarter on what we're dealing with here.
For the record, I'm Alice Edwards. I'm the Director of the Division of Air Quality for the Department of Environmental Conservation. So, you know, we've looked at this bill, and I guess, and we've coordinated with DOT and with Health and Social Services and Department of Labor and Representative Jewell's office on it. And I guess the primary concern from DEC's perspective is trying to ensure that we mitigate any public health impacts that can occur from asbestos exposure that results from being exposed to these naturally occurring asbestos-containing materials that would be used in these projects. And as everybody's mentioned, there is a lot of naturally occurring asbestos up in the Northwest Arctic area that is already there. It's already been used in the communities. There are already exposures there. And Department of Health has done studies up there and are probably better able to speak to the health impacts of asbestos. But primarily, the health impacts that we're looking at are from exposures to inhaled asbestos fibers. So when asbestos materials are used, for example, on a road surface and the dust is kicked up, then, of course, people can inhale it. As far as I'm aware, from a health risk perspective, there's really no safe level of asbestos exposure. So people are currently being exposed in those communities to asbestos from the dust on the roads that are coming up off the roads and from the use of the gravel in other parts of that community. That being said, the health studies, I don't believe, and I would probably defer to public health on this, but I don't believe the health studies showed any actual cases of health concerns that have already occurred as a result of the exposures that are there. But we're looking at the types of health impacts that can occur over a lifetime. So you may not see these cancers or these asbestos-related diseases for quite a long time.
Question, how long has that community been there?
I do not know. I don't know the answer to that question.
I see somebody in the audience said forever. So I would say that if it was harmful and people have lived there forever, we would have found it in the elderly, because they've lived there their whole lifetime.
Potentially. I mean, you do have small populations there. Some people may be more sensitive. And I think I would probably defer to Department of Health and Social Services and the epidemiological folks to tell you better about what the exposure risks might be from exposures. I know that very small exposures can lead to asbestos-related diseases, as well as from very high exposures like you might see with people that are working in industries that have been exposed to asbestos-related materials.
Does it make a difference as far as the short fibers, the long fibers?
I do believe there is some, and I don't have that with me, I do believe there are some differences in the types of forms of asbestos and how those may play out as far as the health risk.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so you have been up there and done measurements of the air quality, so you do have what would be known as baseline data, so that if this bill were to pass and they started using this naturally occurring asbestos and there suddenly became some breathing problems or some other health issues, we would know how much additional asbestos had been added to the air quality because of that, or is that?
I don't know if we would be able to detect the differences. I know we have done air monitoring up there. EPA, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, also did some air sampling up there. We've done air sampling in conjunction with the community, looking at dust and then which is of course particulate matter, and then analyzing that for asbestos. And they've done the health studies. So there has been some baseline work there. Whether we would be able to distinguish new sources from old sources based on new projects, I don't know that we would see those differences, but we might.
Okay.
Well, it's obvious that during the construction time, there's going to be more. I mean, that's common sense tells you that. But, okay, thank you very much. And do you have anything else to add?
Not at this time.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bloomberg.
If we could ask.
Okay, pop back up here, you guys.
And let me, Madam Chair, may I ask, is there anybody here from Department of Law also? Okay, well then, if Emily could come back.
Okay.
And this, Madam Chair, is just something I want to bring up briefly because I don't know much about it, but another issue I'd like to deal with. And we're looking at page 2, lines 11 through 15. And this is going to get to questions of federal preemption. Apparently, people have found that these fibers are a significant threat and are, quote, subject to close regulation by federal and state authorities, and then the sites are given. and those sites are both federal sites under the Clean Air Act and the Toxic Substances Control Act. And apparently these deal with only one issue, use of materials containing naturally occurring asbestos in construction projects. And that may be part of the subject matter here, but not all of it. And so my question to you, Ms. Nauman, and I don't need an answer right now, but have you done research on all the federal legislation that may be on the subject? And to be able to answer a question, are there any constitutional issues of, but not limited to, indirect violations of the Interstate Commerce Clause or the Supremacy Clause because of these apparently close regulation by federal authority? And that's, I don't need an answer right now, Madam Chair, but this is something, I don't want to do something that's going to be struck down on the basis it violates the federal constitution or federal law. Can you answer that through the chair?
Through the chair, and I would be happy to look into this with more detail. My understanding, and I hope I'm right, is that this Clean Air Act and the Toxic Substances Control Act refer to asbestos that is not naturally occurring, that it has been manufactured into products that contain asbestos, and that explains the second clause of this subsection, which says use of materials containing naturally occurring asbestos in construction projects may be regulated by states.
If I may follow through.
Representative Grunberg.
Let's assume you're correct, and I'll assume you're either correct or you'll let us know to the contrary.
Absolutely.
Okay? Assuming that you're correct, are there any other federal regulations that may be involved here? And I know I'm asking you, but we have DEC people. I'm asking anybody to let us know if we're getting ourselves into any trouble on any federal laws here. I think you're being coached by somebody over there. Oh, okay. Anyway, that's just a question. We've got to be careful on this.
Okay. Continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The rest of my sectional is pretty quick. Sections 5 and 6 are both temporary law provisions that help sort of fill the gap after, because this bill has an immediate effective date in Section 7 that allow sort of interim approval of a limited number of projects. And Section 6 states the testing method for gravel containing naturally occurring asbestos that's to be used in the interim.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I'm on a committee, CSG committee, as some of you know, on suggested state legislation. And there's something in this bill that we've discussed in that committee, because we look at the best laws from around the country. And this is Section 6, which...
What page?
Page 10, I'm sorry. Bottom of page 10. And it says, until DOTPA adopts the method of bulk testing, the department shall use California Air Resources Board Method 435, and it's very specific, as that standard has the effective date of the act, as the basis for determining the asbestos content, blah, blah, blah. And I know there are some people, now Senator Coghill was a representative, who are always concerned about deferring our legislative authority, incorporating another state's regulative authority, I mean, our regulative authority being deferred and regulated by somebody else. And on the Committee on Suggested State Legislation, when we looked at various bills, other legislators from other states have expressed similar concerns. I'm not saying whether this is bad or good, but I'm simply pointing out that we're doing that here for the record.
And we're doing it just temporarily.
Correct.
Until our department can get their regulations in line. So I think that I'm, that's not anything I'm going to be worried about at this point.
Okay. I'm not saying that. I just want to.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. We've got some people that do want to testify. Online we have Scott Jones. Can you, or is Scott here? Okay, thank you, Scott. Give us your name again and your affiliation, and then we'll love to hear your testimony. Go ahead, Scott.
I don't know who he is.
Go ahead, Scott.
Just be federal regulation. It'll be under EPA, the federal regulation.
I don't know. I would think so,
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can. We couldn't hear you, but now we do. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, this new title telephone. my name is Scott Jones. I'm the vice mayor in Amber. Currently, I've been vice mayor for 5 or 6 years. Been living in Amber since the 70s. Raised a family here, on and on. I hear so many questions come up on the asbestos issue. Evidently, it takes 25 to 40 years to show up in any sort of health-related thing. As far as I know, the total respiratory failure or people who have had respiratory problems is approximately 20 people in the last 20 or 25 years, but they didn't specify whether they were smokers or not. Smokers are susceptible to this respiratory problems 80 to 100% more than anybody that would be exposed to the NOA and doesn't smoke. I was involved in the airport rehab. I think it was in August of 07, and Nortec did all our testing. We were all the operators, and anybody that was handling any of the material that we put on the airport was tested, and Nortec came back with a finding of no significant impact with the asbestos. ANTHC has had occasion to use the asbestos in Handler. They also did the same testing as Nortec did with the same machinery, with air filters, all the operators, anybody that had access or was around the gravel and had a monitor on. When we did the airport rehab, I think we put 500 yards on the airport and dressed it out and put a palliative on it to keep the dust down. There was monitors in the dustiest places where the airplanes were coming and going. There's 7 different types of asbestos, of which Ambler has the least toxic. The long fiber versus short fiber, we have a long fiber material, and it's not a problem until it gets crushed up and becomes a short fiber material, which from the traffic on the roads and so on, grinds the material down, and then it can become airborne then. Let's see, one of the comments from one of the people that were doing air quality testing, probably in the mid-90s, one of the comments was that there was so much dust in Ambler that they couldn't get a reading on the asbestos, and that their findings was that the silt dust constituted more of a health threat than the actual asbestos. I've got so many things on my mind. I hear this bantering back and forth with trying to get all the legalese and get all the T's crossed and the I's where they're supposed to be, and we're sitting up here with as many as 9 people living in a 2-bedroom house, 3 generations in a 3-bedroom house. We haven't had any houses built here since the early 90s. NIHA being a federally funded deal, anytime that the feds see asbestos any place, they balk at it because it's all, then we can't get anything done because it's all federal money sponsoring all this. And the DOT rehab on the airport, that was a special waiver deal because the FAA refused to allow their maintenance people out at the nav aids because of this dust problem in Adler, and consequently DOT and NANA and the city of Adler got together and made the project happen. Our biggest problem, as I see it, because I've been dealing with this for a while, is that the reason that we can't get any movement on this is because there are no regulations. California has all the regulations and rules. They have all seven types of asbestos, and they've figured out ways to use their material and mitigate the dust problems. And if Alaska came up with a set of rules and operating procedures like we have adopted here when we did the DOT job, like I said, all the operators, everybody was monitored. There was monitors every 200 feet down the runway or whatever they put them in, and collecting the worst-case dust samples when the airplanes came and went. The dusty part of the season is pretty much if we have a good early breakup, June, July, August, and September, and from the middle of September on, it's starting to freeze up, and the dust is less of a problem. So the exposure isn't at an industrial, 40 hours a week, like it would be in a factory or something. If it's a rainy season, it's not dusty. If there's snow on the ground, it's not dusty. I'm kind of winding down here, but I've got so much on my mind. I've been through so many meetings. I'll take any questions that anybody has.
Mr. Jones, could you tell me how many, what was the census that was taken? How many people live there now?
Oh, I believe on the last census, I believe it was 266.
266. And roughly, could you tell me just roughly how many smoke? Just a ball.
It's pretty popular. A lot of the kids, well, I call them kids anymore. They're in their 20s and 30s and all the way up through the elders. Smoking's real common.
About half of them?
I would say probably safely a quarter of the population.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Has anyone considered moving because of the asbestos problem?
Negative. No.
Okay, thank you. Representative Broomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the 14th state legislature, we passed House Bill 5, which was a bill to remove asbestos from the schools and to provide a training program for people to work who work in asbestos. And I'm wondering, and I'm sorry I forgot when Brody was up here, to ask if there had been any thought or any looking at that law to see whether there should be any training of folks who are going to be working in this area and might be exposed to asbestos.
I can't answer that.
No, I was asking if Brody could answer that.
Do you know the answer, Brody?
Through the chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Through the chair, Representative Grimberg. I'm not aware of the statute which you're referring to, so I will look into it and get back to the committee.
I'll be happy to talk with you.
Okay, great.
It wasn't provided at state expense. It's done to private folks.
Okay, we have about four more minutes, and we have one more testifier. Now, there is someone online from Northwest Arctic Borough, and I'm sorry, I probably was going to say this your name wrong, but it's Ukalasek Okalasek.
Well, it's close, yeah. That's right, the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to comment. My name is Ukalasek. I'm the planning director at the Northwest Arctic Borough of Kotzebue.
Go ahead with your testimony.
I give a little orientation. Scott gave a good community overview as vice mayor, but Adler is a really beautiful community for those of you who haven't resource in the 1940s. There was asbestos mining by the Arctic Circle Exploration Company, and that had since, discontinued primarily with World War II, but also with different uses of asbestos falling out of commercial production. But it's a very high quality resource associated with jade. And, of course, there is a mountain called Asbestos Mountain in the area, and also a mountain called Jade Mountain in the area. Some of the investigations into the asbestos and the gravel started in 2003, and there was concerns, I think, by the community and the NELAC Association with the dust. And the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry under the CDC did an investigation report that was published in 2007 that did confirm naturally occurring asbestos in the gravel. The borough does support House Bill 258, and a resolution is going before our assembly later this month. There is a lot of at stake for the villages along the Kobuk River, just not Adler, but potentially in the Kobuk village with the construction of the new school there, and also having to look at naturally occurring asbestos as well as Shungnak. And I know there's other communities in the state of Alaska that also have naturally occurring asbestos, such as Juneau and I think Fairbanks. But one of the good news is about this is that there have been a lot of studies, and DOT has done a great study and came up with a number of conclusions and recommendations, I think, that have since 2003, you know, we're approaching 10 years working on this issue, of recommendations that can be done to use naturally occurring asbestos safely. And there was a report completed, and the committee may want to look at that by NORTEC in September 2009 that also had recommendations on the experiences and policies looking at other states such as California and Virginia that was already mentioned. But one of the significant pieces for the borough is that it is holding up community development. Scott mentioned the airport. It is a huge safety factor. Maintenance of community roads and also the landfill. Building new housing subdivisions due to gravel needs, as well as water and sewer. Once the gravel is removed, replacing that gravel, even just for the maintenance of their system, as well as beach erosion, river erosion projects. So there's a number of community development projects that have been on hold, and the community is really suffering because all this infrastructure that is funded is on hold. And I think what the bill does is a very easy solution to working with this product that can be safe and also proceed with community development.
Okay, thank you. And we do have that report in our backup material, so thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And now we'll have Elizabeth Henley come forward.
Thank you. And we've also got Lance Miller.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Hensley. I am the Corporate and Public Policy Liaison at NANA Regional Corporation. And this is Lance Miller, our Vice President of Resources. So I know we need to be brief here because you've got other things to do too, but thank you very much to Representative Jewell for sponsoring the bill and also for the committee to the committee for hearing the bill. So briefly, I'd like to just go on the record and say NANA Regional Corporation supports this bill. As the people before us said, there are a lot of projects that are on hold and the community needs for them to go forward. It's actually about $10 million worth of projects. The bill is necessary to move these basic infrastructure projects forward, and I mean the only new item I'd like to point out is that the Northwest Arctic Leadership Team, which is the leadership of the Northwest Arctic Borough, the Northwest Arctic Borough School District, Manilik Association, which is our tribal organization, and NANA support the bill. They sent in a letter, and so it's got wide community support in addition to the support of Ambler. Lance, there were a number of questions. I mean, as you might know, NANA is a large landowner in the region. We own about 38,000 square miles of land about the size of Indiana, including a lot of the gravel resource. So Lance can answer any questions or that you might have about the resource.
Thank you. Yeah, and just a few comments again. Lance Miller, Vice President of Resources for NANA, for the record. Pleasure to be here. Just a little bit more about this, and we've heard, and you heard from Scott Jones and Tom up north about it, but this isn't new. The rocks have been there for quite a while. There are these iron-rich rocks which have the various types of asbestos minerals throughout the Brooks Range, southeast Alaska, throughout Alaska. And in answer to Representative Feige's question, and it was addressed, I think, by Scott, this is mainly chrysotile, so it is the least sort of toxic, if you want to use that word, type of asbestos. The problem is, when we looked at it, too, from EPA's, it doesn't matter from that level. It's asbestos-formed minerals, so we're kind of stuck with that. I guess not to reiterate too much about, but again, the projects that have been on hold, as Elizabeth said, it's about $10 million. Many years. But I think the other thing that strikes me is when we're in the Upper Kobuk, and as people say, it's not just how long has AMLU been there. AMLU is actually a relatively new village, but people have been up along the river for many years, maybe upwards of 10,000. And actually, some of the highest concentrations of asbestos are in the gravel bars right in front of AMLU and other places, because it is a winnowing effect. You get, that's where you get the asbestos, on the gravel bars. So it has been around for a long time. There was reference to the CDC study through the Department of Toxics, or whatever it is referred to. And again, I think they came up with some pleural plaques on a few folks, but there was no mesothelioma. So again, exposure, it's a good question, but it's been around for a long time and people have been breathing it. So yeah, again, we just like to be on record to support this bill to move these projects forward. And frankly, because of the lack of legislation, it is really an issue for landowners and for the immunity part. So that's really it. However, as Scott also mentioned, we have moved ahead on some critical things, airport, some emergency issues as well. So I think people heard enough, unless there's specific questions. Thank you for your time.
Representative Grunberg.
Depending upon how committee discussions go in future meetings on the immunity issue, would you folks be available by telephone or anything to answer some questions that may arise at that time? Madam Chair, I'm not going to ask questions at this time when we don't know what we're going to do, the final product. But at some point when we do the final product, or we're considering them, I would like the regional corporations and other people who are involved to weigh in on how this will affect them and whether they'll be able to proceed.
Yeah, we certainly are. Anytime.
I just think it's premature critical at this point to ask.
Well, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to set this bill aside. I would like to hear it next week, though. So what I'd like to do, anybody that has any concerns, make sure you get with Brody and anybody else, Emily, and that's going to be your responsibility to make sure that happens so that we can I think 10 years for this community to be without economic development at all is pretty tough. And so I would like to get this bill moved out as soon as I can, but I think it does need a little more work. So thank you very much. And I will zip right on to the next bill, and that bill is House Bill 270. Representative Sisna, please come forward and introduce yourself and your bill. And I have to leave at 5 till. I have an appointment with the governor, and so I think if I'm not, yep, you can finish up on this. I do plan to hold the bill anyway, but we want to get it introduced so that we can bring it up at another time when we have time.
Thank you very much on all counts, because I think we want the same future. For the record, Madam Chair. My name is Sharon Cisner. I'm a state representative from District 22 in Anchorage. And I am bringing forward a bill that does what I believe is imperative for the process that we now have at Alaskan airports. And it was in December of this last year that all of a sudden Alaska had a system of procedures that had been missing a part, and that was a scanner. They did do the invasive, and I call it examination. They had done that prior to that, but with the metal detector, the metal detector didn't catch a lot of the things that the new scanners do. And although the new scanner in the Alaskan airports does not see the body as it would be seen without clothing, it's a much vaguer, and that's probably not the right term, but it's not a picture of the human body. What it, and I've seen the actual screen where it actually has a symbol that shows that there's something unusual there. And in that being the case, that you've seen now that here is this human's body and there's problems here. Well, those problems might be a bomb, probably because of the fact that you're looking at population in a lot of cases that are aging. It's more likely to be an implant, a medical implant, missing body part because of an injury in war. It might be a cancer case where they lost that body part. It might be something they're born with. It might be a huge number of things. And so then they go into a procedure which is invasive. Now, what we have found out in the first year, I got into the picture in February 20th of this last year, and from February 20th to the end of this last year, I received over 1,000 letters from people, emails and letters from people who had actually gone through this procedure. No, all over the country, but I'd say I think we had about 300 out of about 1,100, somewhere right in that neighborhood. So in other words, a large percentage of them really from Alaska. But then I also have people who stop me on the street, who come into my office here and in Anchorage, telling me their stories. And the reaction of people, my own personal reaction, is a reaction that you're getting from someone who has been traumatized. And that's certainly my reaction, and that's what I'm being told by other people as well, for lots of different reasons, for many different things. And certainly in some cases, it's people taking their children and having things happen. It's them taking their parents who are elderly. It's many, many different situations. So this is occurring because of the United States' reaction to 9/11. And I am, let me say that I've been on military and veterans affairs in this body more than, right around 10 years, and I'm a member of my community patrol, so I am a person very concerned about security. But I think many of the people that I've talked to, many of the people who have written and talked, probably some of you as well, it is not as much a concern about security as it is a concern about the loss of an independence that came about because of Constitution. And that people now are feeling as if they've lost something. So what this bill does, and if you have read it, it says that at the airports, that what is required from the Department of Transportation and public facilities is the ones that actually are affected by TSA, the TSA only is at certain airports. They're usually the larger airports, the ones that are going to be flying directly to the lower states that are flying bigger planes. The small airports, they're not there. But the, and I think there's actually a size of airplane that that down below or at that line they stop. So this bill essentially would have all of those ones covered by TSA to apply for a TSA opt-out form, and that is an actual form. And I just, unfortunately, I remember, I think I gave it away. But if you did not have a copy of that form, did you get a sent a copy of that form? I'll make sure you guys have it. Because that is really, well, no, actually, pardon me, I've had too many things on my mind. And I'm talking about something that you're not supposed to need to have here. The thing that each airport is going to be required to do is, and again, this is only the airports where, in fact, TSA would actually be functioning. They would need to be having a sign, and I think I was just told that it would be essentially 11 by 14 would be the size of the sign, and that would be posted outside of the security area, and that message, it'd be essentially a passenger warning sign, and it gives the passenger an awareness of what they're about to walk into. And one of the things that I have noted over and over again is there's kind of a real attitudinal problem that people get when they walk into a facility that expects something of them that it actually is going to be difficult for them, and nobody warned them. They didn't hear about it. They didn't know it was going to be this way. They didn't realize the way people were going to talk to them. And this is the notice of exactly what's in front of people. It actually gives the consumer who paid the money to get the ticket, who spent a couple hours extra in the packing to make sure that they weren't carrying things they'd been warned about, and it reminds them of what they're walking into, that they're walking forward into an area that they have made a decision to walk forward into. It gives them the notice that seems in our state, when it's only been a few months now that this has occurred, and in many communities hasn't even started yet, it gives people a warning. And the thing that I think many people don't understand about the state of Alaska is that we have a huge number of airports that are actually owned by the Department of Transportation. And I only this afternoon discovered that not only do they own the land that the airports are on, but in most cases, those are leased. Now, that's something I hadn't realized. What we know also is that there's, for instance, in Juneau here, that's a Muni-owned airport. Same is true in Ketchikan, and then there's several other, as I understand it, airports that it's run by municipalities or other organizations. The airports that the state government owns and is leased, those leasing entities in what's right would be getting notice of the signage that goes up. And the signs are, I saw a sample of it, would be very small. I mean, it's not really a huge thing. It's not taking up a great deal of space. But there may well be some of those airports that may look at this in a way that I can't even guess, because I found this out this afternoon. So what I'd love to ask the committee to do, and the chair already gave this indication, is I'd love to answer any questions, go into any questions any of you have, and then I would really appreciate it if you in fact did hold this, because I think one of the things that there is a moral duty on my part, and the co-chairs, to check with those proprietors of the leased land and find out if we've done this in a way that it fits into what they want. I think it's really imperative to give the traveling public notice of what they're walking into. And so many times when you have the knowledge, when in fact you're prepared, you react quite differently than when you're shocked by what happens because you weren't told. This gives people a chance to be informed consent, essentially.
Okay. Well, we've got about 2 minutes, and the chair did indicate that she wanted to hold it. Are there any questions?
Minos. Thank you, and thank you for your courage on this issue. You've really been led and really raised the awareness, and I
thank you.
You know, I admire you for that.
Thank you.
My question is on the radiation issue. The new devices I've heard have greater radiation emission. Do you know what that is and how it compares to the more traditional devices?
My problem with that radiation equipment, I don't really know the answer, but I'll tell you what my problem is, and that is there is no third-party oversight on really any of the TSA stuff. When it was first put in place, there was oversight, and then somewhere around 2006, Congress gave TSA essentially an open ticket to write their own rules and regulations, and they don't answer to questions about things. They give information, but there's no way to check on third party, sure, scientific reviews, that kind of thing, to make sure that in fact they are secure. And I saw the forms that were done on this equipment from one of the big scientific organizations. It had all kinds of crossed out things, you know, the big bold crossed out, and it said numerous sub-statements about if these regulations are enacted and the different suggestions that the company that constructed the equipment tells, if it's not installed properly, if it's not checked regularly, then it won't be as safe as what we're saying. And there's no notices anywhere on whether or not those get calibrated correctly or how they were installed. There's none of that. So the question is in my mind, and if we're thinking safety and prevention, as a state, I believe our duty is to be extremely careful.
Thank you, Representative Minos. Representative Feige, did you want to ask a question?
I think you more or less answered it, but I'll ask it anyway. What is the radiation quantity that is emitted by the machine? What's the nature of it? Is it radiation, or is it simply electromagnetic?
My education, actually, and my work practice has never been with any kind of equipment like that, so I'm not a good person to actually ask that of. My understanding from people who have talked to me about this, who actually have worked in hospitals, places that have had more of this kind of equipment have said that it's a slower traveling radiation and that that in itself is of concern. And that's what I've been told. That's all I know.
Okay. Well, seeing no other questions, I thank you, Representative Sisna, for your testimony. And we will adjourn. The next meeting is Thursday, or we will not be meeting on Thursday, the 23rd. So, see you next Tuesday. Adjourn.